guests in Kingston, including Anla from Reynolds from Argentina, Rump State, which includes Mark Morgan from the band Sightings, Decimus with members of the No Neck Blues Band, and Rambutan, Eric Hardiman and Michael Kafer from Albany, and Doubles from Kingston. That's all at Tubby's in Kingston on Thursday, December 1st. Go to the WJXC community calendar online for more information about this event and many others in your community.
Survive All, one of the nation's leading manufacturers of fallout shelters, now combines sturdy steel with durable concrete block for
a civil defense approved basement type do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Ensure protection for your family. See a Survive All shelter today.
WJXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Becca Van Kay of Catskill, New York. WJXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WJXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WJXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WJXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
You are listening to Transmission Arts Programming on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. You're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, and the name of this show is Good Night, Norman. Right here in WGXC 90.7 FM. On your upstate community dial, WGXC.org, and the rest of the world. Tonight I'm reading Jim Thompson, The Frightening Premise, story from February 1957. Two of Thompson's novels, at least I've seen, were made into films. Killer Inside Me. That was Casey Affleck. And The Grifters. This one, like I said, The Frightening Premise. From 1957. For perhaps the 100th time that day, Mitch Allison squared his shoulders, wreathed his face with an engaging grin, and swung his thumb in a gesture as old as hitchhiking. And for perhaps the 100th time, his appeal was rudely ignored. The oncoming car roared down on him and past him, wiping the forced grin from his face with a nauseous blast of its exhaust. Mitch cursed it hideously as he continued walking, damning the car's manufacturer, its owner, and finally, and most fulsomely, himself. Just couldn't be satisfied, could you? he grumbled bitterly. Sitting right up on top of the world, and it wasn't good enough for you. Well, how do you like this, you stupid, dull-witted, moronic, blankety-blank-blank? Mitch Allison was not the crying kind. He'd grown up in a world where tears were more apt to inspire annoyance than sympathy, and a sob was likely to get you a punch in the throat. Still, he was very close to weeping now. If there had been any tears in him, he would have bawled with sheer shame and self-exasperation. Less than a day ago, he had possessed almost $20,000, the proceeds from robbing his wife, swindling the madam of a parlor house, and pulling an intricate double cross on several quote-unquote business associates. Moreover, since it had been imperative for him to clear out of L.A., his hometown, he had had a deluxe stateroom on the eastbound Super Chief. And then, well, there was this elderly couple, retired farmers ostensibly, who had just sold their orange grove for a five-figure sum. So Mitch had tied into them, as the con man saying goes, suggesting a friendly little card game. What happened then was figuratively murder. This nice old couple had taken him like Grant took Richmond. Their apparently palsied hands had made the cards perform in a manner which even Mitch, with all his years of suckering chumps, would have declared impossible. He couldn't believe his own eyes, his own senses. His 20 grand was gone, and the supposed suckers were giving him the merry ha-ha in a matter of 2 hours. Mitch had threatened to beat them into hamburger if they didn't return his dough, and that, of course, was a mistake. The compounding of one serious error with another. For the elderly couple, far more practiced in the con than he, had impeccable references and identification, while Mitch's were both scanty and lousy. He couldn't establish legitimate ownership to 20 cents, let alone 20 grand. Certainly he was no position to explain how he had come by that 20 grand. His attempts to do so when the old couple summoned the conductor had led him into one palpable lie after another. In the end, he had had to jump the train, sans baggage and ceremony, in order to avoid arrest. So now here he was, broke, disgusted, footsore, hungry, hitchhiking his way back to Los Angeles, where he probably would get killed as soon as he was spotted. Even if no one else cared to murder him, his wife, Bet, would be itching to do so. Still, the guy had to go someplace, didn't he? And having softened up Bet before, perhaps he could do it again. It was a chance, his only chance. A hustling man needs a good front. Right now, Mitch looked like the king of the tramps. Brushing the sweat from his eyes, he paused to stare at a sign attached to a roadside tree, Los Angeles, 125 miles. He looked past the sign into the inviting shade of the trees beyond it. The ocean would be over there somewhere, not too far from the highway, if he could wash up a little, rinse out his shirt and underwear. He sighed, shook his head, and walked on. It wasn't worth the trouble, he decided. It wasn't safe. The way his luck was running, he'd probably wade into a school of sharks. In the distance, he heard another car approach. Warily, knowing he had to try, Mitch turned and swung his thumb. It was a Cadillac, a big black convertible. As it began to slow down, Mitch had a feeling that no woman had ever given him such a going over and seemed to like so well what she saw as the one sitting next to the caddy's driver. The car came on slower and slower. It came even with him, and the woman asked, "How far to El Ciudad?" El Ciudad? The car was creeping past him. Mitch had to trot along at its side to answer the question. "You mean the resort? About 50 miles, I think." "I see." The woman stared at him searchingly. "Would you like a ride?" she asked. "Would I?" She winked at Mitch, spoke over her shoulder to the man behind the wheel. "All right, stupid, stop. We're giving this guy a ride." The man grunted a dispirited curse. The car stopped, then spurted forward savagely as Mitch clambered into the back seat. What a jerk. The woman stared disgustedly at her companion. Can't even give a guy a ride without trying to break his neck. I'll dry you up, the man said wearily. Drop dead. So damn tight you squeak. If I'd only known what you were like before I married you. Ditto. Double U in spades. The woman took a pint of whiskey from the glove compartment, drank from it, and casually handed it back to Mitch. He took a long, thirsty drink and started to pass the bottle back, but she had turned away again, become engrossed and nagging at her husband. Mitch was just a little embarrassed by the quarrel, but only a little. Mitch Allison was not a guy to be easily or seriously embarrassed. He took another drink and then another. Gratefully, he settled down into the deeply upholstered seat, listening disinterestedly to the woman's brittle voice and her husband's retorts. Jerk, you stingy, selfish, she was saying. Ah, babe, lay off, will you? It's our honeymoon, and I'm taking you to one of the nicest places in the country. Oh, sure, taking me there during the off-season, because you're just too cheap and jealous to live it up a little, because you don't want anyone to see me. Now, that isn't so, babe. I just want to be alone with you, that's all. Well, I don't want to be alone with you. 1 week in a lifetime is enough for me. Mitch wondered what kind of chump he could be to take that sort of guff from a dame. In his own case, if Bette had ever talked that way to him, pow, she'd be spitting out teeth for the next year. The woman's voice grew louder, sharper. The slump to her husband's shoulders became more pronounced. Incuriously, Mitch tried to determine what he looked like without those outsized sunglasses and the pulled low motoring cap, but he didn't figure long. The guy straightened suddenly, swerved the car off into a grass-grown trail, and slammed on the brakes. Mitch was almost thrown from the seat. The husband leapt from the car and went stomping off into the trees. She called after him angrily, profanely. Without turning, he disappeared from view. The woman shrugged and looked humorously at Mitch. Some fun, huh? Guess I rode hubby a little too hard. Yeah, said Mitch. Seems that you did. Well, he'll be back in a few minutes. Just has to sulk a little first. She was red-haired, beautiful in a somewhat hard-faced way, but there was nothing hard-looking about her figure. She had the kind of shape a guy dreams about but seldom sees. Mitch's eyes lingered on her. She noticed his gaze. You like me, mister? She said softly. You like to stay with me? Huh? Mitch licked his lips. Now look, lady. You like to have this car? You like to have half of $50,000? Mitch always had been a fast guy on the uptake, but this babe was pitching right past him. Now look, he repeated shakily. You look, she said. Take a good look. There was a briefcase in the front seat. She opened it and handed it back to Mitch. Mitch looked. He reached inside, took out a handful of its contents. The briefcase was filled, or at least half-filled, with traveler's checks of $100 denominations. Filled, practically speaking, with $100 bills. They would have to be countersigned, of course, but that was... It's a cinch, the woman said intently. Look at the signature. No curly Q's, no fancy stuff. All you have to do is sign the name, Martin Lonsdale. Just sign it, plain and simple, and we're in. But, Mitch shook his head, but I'm not. But you could be Martin Lonsdale. You could be my husband, if you were dressed up, if you had his ID. Her voice faded at the look Mitch gave her, and then resumed again sulkily. Well, why not? I got a few rights, haven't I? He promised me the world with a ring around it if I'd marry him, and now I can't get a nickel out of him. I can't even tap his wallet because he keeps all of his dough out of my hands with tricks like this. Tough, said Mitch. That's really tough. It is. He returned the checks to the briefcase, snapped the lock on it, and tossed it back into the front seat. How could I use his ID unless he was dead? Think he'd just go to sleep somewhere until I cashed the checks and made a getaway? The girl flounced around in her seat. Then she shrugged and got out. Well, she said, as long as that's the way you feel. We'll get hubby, right? Mitch also got out of the car. Sure we will. You and me together. We'll see that he gets back safe and sound, won't we? She whirled angrily and stomped off ahead of him. Grinning, Mitch followed her through the trees and the underbrush. There was an enticing roll to her hips, a deliberately exaggerated roll. She drew her skirt up a little on the pretext of quickening her stride, and her long, perfectly shaped legs gleamed alluringly in the shade-dappled sunlight. Mitch admired the display dispassionately, admired it without being in the least tempted. She was throwing everything she had at him, and what she had was plenty. And he, Mitch Allison, would be the first guy to admit that she had it. Still, she was a bird. 110 pounds of pure poison. Mitch grimaced distastefully. He wished she would backtalk him a little, give him some reason to put the slug on her. He knew she was too smart to do it. They emerged from the trees and came out on the base of a cliff overlooking the ocean. The man's trail clearly led here, but he was nowhere in sight. Mitch shot an inquiring glance at the girl. She shrugged, but her face had paled. Mitch stepped cautiously to the edge of the cliff and looked down. Far below, a good 100 feet at least, was the ocean, roiled, oily-looking, surging thunderously with the great foam-flecked waves of the incoming tide. It was an almost straight-up-and-down drop to the water. About halfway down, snagged on a bush that sprouted from the cliff face, was a man's motoring cap. Mitch's stomach turned sickishly. Then he jumped and whirled as a wild scream rent the air. It was the girl. She was kneeling, sobbing hysterically at the base of a tree. Her husband's coat was there, suspended from a broken-off branch, and she was holding a slip of paper in her hands.
"I didn't mean it," she wept. "I wouldn't have done it. I was just sore, and..."
Mitch told her curtly to shut up. He took the note from her and read it. His lips pursed with a mixture of disdain and regret. It was too bad, certainly. Death was always regrettable, whether brought on by one's own hand or another's. Still, a guy who would end his life over a dame like this, well, the world hadn't lost much by the action, and neither had he. Mitch wadded the note and tossed it over the cliff. He frisked the coat and tossed it after the note. Then, briskly, he examined the wallet and personal papers of the late Martin Lonsdale. There was a telegram confirming reservations at El Ciudad Hotel and Country Club. There was a registration certificate, proof of ownership, on the Cadillac. There was a driver's license and a photostat of Martin Lonsdale's discharge from the Army. Mitch examined the last two items with particular care. Brown hair, gray eyes. Yep, that was all right. That matched the description of his own eyes and hair. Weight, 180. Right on the nose again. Complexion, fair. Okay also. Height, 6'1". Mitch frowned slightly. Lonsdale hadn't looked to be over 5'8" or 5'9". So nothing. Lonsdale's shoulders had been slumped. He, Mitch, had only seen the man on his feet for a few seconds. At any rate, the height on the papers matched his own, and that was all that mattered. The girl was still on her knees, weeping. Mitch told her to knock it off, for God's sake. When she persisted, he kicked her lightly in the stomach. That stopped the tears, but it pulled the stopper on some of the dirtiest language he had ever heard. Mitch listened to it for a moment, then gave her a stinging slap on the jaw. "You just passed the first plateau," he advised her pleasantly. "From now on, you won't get less than a handful of knuckles. Like to try for it, or will you settle for what you got?"
"You dirty, lousy, two-bit tinhorn," she glared at him. "I just lost my husband and..."
"Which was just what you wanted," Mitch nodded. "So cut the fake sob stuff. You wanted him dead, okay? You got your wish, and with no help from me. So now let's see if we can't do a little business together."
"Why the hell should I do business with you? I'm his widow. I've got a legal claim on the car and the dough."
"Uh-huh," Mitch nodded judiciously. "Maybe you can collect, too, if you care to wait long enough. if there ain't any other claims against the estate. And, of course, you're still alive.
Alive? What do you...
I mean, you might be executed for murder, you know? A certain tall and handsome young man might tell the cops you pushed Martin off of that cliff. He grinned at her. The girl's eyes blazed, then dulled in surrender. All right, she mumbled. All right. But do you have to be so nasty, so cold-blooded? Can't you act like a... Mitch hesitated. He had less than no use for her, and it was difficult to conceal the fact. Still, when you had to do business with a person, it was best to maintain the appearance of friendliness. We'll get along all right, babe. He smiled boyishly, gave her a wink. This LCU Dodd place, is Martin known there? He's never even in California before. Swell, that strengthens my ID. Gives us a high-class base of operations while we're cashing these checks. There's one more thing, though. Mitch looked down at the telegram. This only confirms a reservation for Martin Lonsdale. Well, it wouldn't necessarily have to mention his wife, would it? There's plenty of room at this time of the year. Mitch nodded. Now about the clothes. Maybe I'm wrong, but Marty looked quite a bit smaller then. They'll fit you, the girl said firmly. Marty bought his clothes a little big. Thought they wore longer that way, you know? She proved to be right. Except for his shoes, the dead man's clothes fitted Mitch perfectly. Mitch retained only his own shoes and socks, threw his other clothes into the ocean. Redressed in clean underwear, an expensive white shirt and tie, and a conservative-looking blue serge suit, he climbed behind the wheel of the car. The girl, Babe, snuggled close to him. He backed out onto the highway and headed for LCU Dodd. Babe laid her head against his shoulder. This is nice, isn't it, honey? It's going to be a lot nicer, isn't it, when we get to the hotel? She shivered deliciously. Mitch suppressed a shudder. We'll cash the checks, she murmured, and split the dough. We'll sell the car and split on that. We'll divide everything, even Stephen, won't we, honey? Well, won't we? Sure, naturally, Mitch said hastily. You just bet we will. And he added silently, like hell. LCU Dodd is just a few miles beyond the outer outskirts of L.A., a truly magnificent establishment during the tourist season. It was now, in midsummer, anything but. The great lawns are brown and tinder dry. The long rows of palm trees were as unappetizing as banana stalks. The tennis courts were half hidden by weeds. Emptied of water and drifted almost full of dried leaves and rubble, the swimming pool looked like some mammoth compost pit. The only spots of brightness were the red and white mailbox at the head of the driveway and a green telephone booth at the first tee of the golf course. Briefly, the exterior of the place was a depressing mess. Inside, it was even less prepossessing. The furniture was draped with dust covers. Painters' drop cloths, lumber, and sacks of plaster were strewn about the marble floor. Scaffolds reared toward the ceiling and ladders were propped along the walls. There was only skeleton staff on duty. They were as dejected-looking as the establishment itself. The manager, also doubling as clerk, was unshaven and obviously suffering from a hangover. He apologized curtly for the disarray, explaining that the workmen who were refurbishing the place had gone on strike. Not that it makes much difference, he added. Of course, we regret the inconvenience to you. He didn't appear to regret it, but you're our only guest. He cashed one of the $100 checks for Mitch, his fingers lingering hungrily over the money. A bellboy in a baggy uniform showed Mr. and Mrs. Lonsdale to their suite. It consisted of two rooms and a connecting bath. Mitch looked it over, dismissed the bellboy with a dollar tip, and dropped into a chair in front of the air conditioning vent. You know, he told Babe, I'm beginning to understand your irritation with Marty. If this is a sample of his behavior, going to a winter resort in the middle of summer. A double distilled jerk, Babe agreed. Scared to death someone might make a play for me. Mitch frowned thoughtfully. You're sure that was his only reason? No matter how scared he was of competition, this deal just doesn't seem to make sense. Well, the girl hesitated. Of course, he probably didn't know it would be this bad.
kitchens and dining room of El Ciudad were not in operation, but the bellboy made and served them soggy sandwiches and muddy coffee. He also supplied them with a bottle of whiskey at double the retail price. They had a few drinks and ate. Then, with another drink in front of him, Mitch sat down at the desk and began practicing the signature of Martin Lonsdale. For the one check, the one cashed by the manager, he had done all right. There was only $100 involved, and the manager had no reason to suspect the signature. But it would be a different story tomorrow when he began hitting the banks. Then he'd be cashing checks in wholesale lots, cashing them with people whose business it was to be suspicious. His forgeries would have to be perfect or else. So he practiced and he continued to practice, pausing occasionally to massage his hand or exchange a word with the girl. When finally he achieved perfection, he started to work on the checks. Babe stopped him, immediately wary, alarmed. "What are you doing? Aren't they supposed to be countersigned where they're cashed?" Mitch shrugged. "Not necessarily. I can write my name in front of the person who does the cashing. Just establish, you know, my signature is the same as the one on the checks."
"Yeah, but why?"
"To save time, damn it. This is a forgery job, you remember? We hold all the cards, but it is a forgery, which means we have to hit it and quit it. Cash in and disappear, because sooner or later there's going to be a rumble. Now, if you're afraid I'm going to go on the lam... Now, if you're afraid I'm going to lamb out with these things..." "Oh, no, of course I'm not, honey." But she stuck right with him until he'd finished countersigning the checks. She was quite prepared, in fact, to spend the rest of the night. Mitch didn't want that. He shoved the checks back into the briefcase, locked it, and thrust it into her hands. "Keep it," he said. "Put it under your pillow. Now get out of here so I can get some sleep." He began to undress. The girl looked at him poutingly.
"But, honey, I thought we were going to..."
"We're both worn out," Mitch pointed out, "and there's another night coming." He climbed into bed and turned on his side. Babe left reluctantly. She took the briefcase with her, and she locked the connecting door on her side of the bathroom. Mitch rolled over on his back, wide-eyed, staring up into the darkness. He pondered the problem of giving Babe a wild, well-deserved rookin'. It was simple enough in a way. That is, the preliminary steps were simple enough. After, and if he successfully cashed the checks tomorrow, he had only to catch her off guard and put her on ice for the night. Bind and gag her, lock her up in one of the clothes closets. From that point on, however, he wasn't sure what to do. Or rather, he knew what to do, but he didn't know how the hell he was going to do it. He couldn't scram in the caddy. A wagon like that would leave a trail a blind man could follow. For similar reasons, he couldn't zoom away in a taxi, if, that is, it was possible to get a taxi this far from the city. How was he going to do it, then? Equally important, where would he hide out if he was able to do it? For he'd sure as hell have to hide out fast after this caper. Babe would squawk bloody murder. It wouldn't make her anything, but she'd sure squawk. Her body was soft and lush, but one look at that cast-iron mug of hers and you knew she would squawk. So Mitch scowled in the darkness. Now, Bet, his wife, had a nondescript car. She could get him away from here. She could hide him out indefinitely. She could, but it was preposterous to think she would, not after the last stunt he'd pulled on her. Yeah, he'd planned on pleading forgiveness before his meeting with Martin and Babe Lonsdale, but the situation had been different then. There wasn't any $50,000 at stake. It wasn't the risk of a long prison stretch. If he appealed to Bet, he'd have to give her the full pitch on this deal, which meant, naturally, that he'd completely be at her mercy. And if she wasn't feeling merciful, if he couldn't fast-talk her into giving him a break, well, that would be the end of the sleigh ride. Enter the cops. Mitch, exit Mitch, Allison, and $50,000. "I'm going to have to stop crooking everyone," Mitch thought. "From now on, I'm going to be honest with at least one person." He fell asleep on this pious thought. Almost immediately, it seemed, it was morning, and Babe was shaking him awake. They headed into Los Angeles, stopping at a roadside diner for breakfast. As they ate, Mitch consulted the classified telephone directory, organizing an itinerary for the day's operations. Because of the time factor, his targets, the banks, had to be in the same general area.
On the other hand, they had to be separated by a discreet distance, lest he be spotted going from one to another. Needless to say, it was also essential that he tackle only independent banks. Branch banks with their central reference systems would nail a paper pusher on a second try. Babe watched Mitch work, admiration in her eyes, and increasing caution. He is one sharp cookie, she thought, as sharp as he was tough, a lot sharper than she'd ever be. Being the kind of dame she was, she'd contemplated throwing a curve to win. Now she knew that wouldn't do it. She'd have to put the blocks to him before he could do it to her. She was lingering in the background when he approached the teller's cage at the first bank. She was never more than a few feet away from him throughout the day, one of the most nerve-wracking in Mitch Allison's career. He began by pushing 10 of the traveler's checks, $1,000 at a time. A lead pipe cinch was his appearance and identification. Usually a teller would do it on his own, or if not, an executive okay was a mere formality. Unfortunately, as Mitch soon realized, these $1,000 strikes couldn't get the job done. He was too short on time. He'd run out of banks before he ran out of checks, so he upped the ante to $2,000, finally to $3,000. Then things really tightened up. Tellers automatically referred him to execs. The executives passed him up the line to superiors. He was questioned, quizzed, studied narrowly. Again and again, the credentials were examined. The description on them checked off item by item with his own appearance. By 3:10, when he disposed of the last check, his nerves were in knots. He and Babe drove to a nearby bar where he tossed down a few quick ones. Considerably calmer then, he headed the car toward El Ciudad. Look, honey, Babe turned suddenly in the seat, faced him. Why are we going back to that joint anyway? We got the dough. Why not just dump this car for a price and beat it? Just go off and leave the baggage? Start a lot of inquiries? Mitch shook his head firmly. Well, no, I guess that wouldn't be so good, would it? But you said we ought to disappear fast. When are we going to do it? Mitch slanted a glance at her, deliberating over his reply. Well, I can get a guy here in L.A. to shoot me a come-quick telegram. It'll give us a legitimate excuse for pulling out tomorrow morning. Babe nodded dubiously. She suggested to Mitch phone his friend now instead of calling through El Ciudad's switchboard. Mitch said he couldn't. The guy works late, see? He won't be home yet. I'll call him from that phone booth out on the golf course. That'll keep anyone from listening in. I see, Babe repeated. You think of everything, don't you, darling? They had dinner at a highway drive-in. Around dusk, Mitch brought the car to a stop on El Ciudad's parking lot. Babe reached hesitantly for the briefcase. Mitch told her to go right ahead, to take it with her. Just don't forget, sweetheart, I can see both entrances to the joint, and I got the keys to the buggy. Now, don't you worry one bit, Babe smiled at him brightly. I'll be right inside, waiting for you. She headed for the hotel, waving to him gaily as she passed through the entrance. Mitch sauntered out to the phone booth and placed a call to Bet. Rather, since she hung up on him the first few times, he placed 3 calls. At last, she stayed on the wire and he was able to give her the pitch. The result was anything but reassuring. She said she'd be seeing him. She'd be out just as fast as she could make it. He could depend on it, but there was an ominous quality to her voice, a distinctly unwifely tone. Before he could say anything more, she slammed the receiver for the 3rd and last time. Considerably disturbed, Mitch walked back across the dead and dying grass and entered the hotel. The manager clerk's eyes shied away from him. The elevator bellboy was similarly furtive. Absorbed in his worry over Bet, Mitch didn't notice. He got off at his floor and started down the hall, ducking around scaffolding and wending his way through a littered jungle of paint cans, plaster, and wallpaper. He came to his room. He opened the door and entered. Then something crashed down on his head. It was dark when Mitch regained consciousness. He sat up, massaging his aching head, staring dizzily at the shattered glass on the floor, remains of a broken whiskey bottle. Then he remembered. Realization came to him, and ripping out a curse, He ran to the window. The caddy was still there in the parking lot. Yeah, and the keys were still in his pocket. Mitch whirled, ran to the bathroom, and kicked open the door to the other room. It was empty and immaculate order, sans babe and sans bagage. There was nothing to indicate it had ever been tenanted. Mitch tottered back into his own room, and there was a knock on the door. He flung it open. A man walked in and closed it behind him. He looked at Mitch. He looked down at the broken bottle. He shook his head in mild disapproval. "So you are supposedly a sick man, Marty," he said gutturally. "So you have a great deal of money. My money. So drunk you should not get." "What?" Mitch said. "Who the hell are you?" "So I am the pig," the man said. "Who else?" The name suited him. Place a pecan on top of a hen's egg and you got a good idea of his appearance. He was perhaps 5 foot tall and probably weighed 300 pounds. His arms were short almost to the point of deformity. He had a size 6 head and a size 60 waistline. Mitch stared at him blankly, silently. The pig apparently misunderstood this attitude. "So, you are not sure of me. So I will take it from the top and give you proof. So you are the man's good and faithful servant through all his difficulties. So the man passes the word that you are to pay me $50,000 for services rendered. So you are a very sick man anyway and have little to lose if detected while on the errand." "Now wait a minute," Mitch said. I'm not. "So you are to transport the money in small traveler's checks. So you cannot be robbed. So they can easily be cashed without attracting unwanted attention. So you have had a day to cash them. So," the pig concluded firmly, "you will give me the $50,000. Mitch's mouth was very dry. Slowly the various pieces of a puzzle were beginning to add up. And what they added up to was curtains for him. He'd really stepped into something this time. A grade A jam, an honest to Hannah double distilled Framis. The pig's next words were proof. "So you know how I earned the 50 G's, Marty. So you would not like me to give you a demonstration. It is better to die a natural death." Listen, Mitch stammered. "You got the wrong guy. I'm not Martin Lawnsdale. Look, I'll show you." He started to reach for his wallet and groaned silently, remembering he had thrown it away. There was a risk of being caught with two sets of ID. So, the pig said. Look, call this man, whoever he is. Let me talk to him. He can tell you I'm not. So, the pig grunted, who can call Alcatraz? So, he added, I will have the money, Marty. I don't have it. The dame I registered in with, she has it. She has the room next to mine, and so, but no. So I checked the registry myself. So there has been no woman with you. I tell you there was. These people here, they're hungry as hell, see? She had plenty of dough to bribe them. He broke off, realizing how true his words were. He resumed again, desperately. Let me give you the whole pitch. Tell you just what happened right from the beginning. I was trying to thumb a ride, see, and this big Cadillac stopped for me, and Mitch told him the tale. The pig was completely unimpressed. So that is a 50 grand story? So a better one I could buy for a nickel? But it's true. Would I make up a yarn like that? Would I come here knowing that you'd show up to collect? So people do stupid things, the pig shrugged. So also, I am a day early. But... damn it, there was a discreet rap on the door. Then it opened, and Bet came in. This Bet was a honey, a little skimpy in the chin department, maybe, but she had plenty everywhere else. A burlesque house strip teaser. Her mannerisms and dress sometimes caused her to be mistaken for a member of a far older profession. Mitch greeted her with almost hysterical gladness. Tell this guy, honey, for God's sake. Tell him who I am. Tell him. Bet hesitated, her eyes flickering. Why, you're Martin Lawnsdale, I guess. If this is your room,
Didn't you send for me to... No, Mitch Burble, don't do this to me, honey. Tell him who I really am, please. One of the pig's fat arms moved casually. The fist at the end of it smashed into Mitch's face. It was like being slugged with a brick. Mitch stumbled and fell flat across the bed. Dully, as from a distance, he heard a murmur of conversation. Had a date with him, $100 date, and I came all the way out here from L.A. So Marty has another date, so I will pay the $100 myself. There was a crisp rustle, then a dulcet, oh, aren't you nice? Then the door opened and closed, and Bet was gone. The pig slowly approached the bed. He had a hand in his pocket. There was a bigger bulge in his pocket than a hand should make. Mitch feigned unconsciousness until the pig's hand started coming out of his pocket. Then Mitch's legs whipped up in a blur of motion. He went over backwards in a full somersault and landed on the other side of the bed, gripped and jerked it upward. Speed was not the pig's forte. He just wasn't built for it. He tried to get out of the way and succeeded only in tripping over his own feet. The bed came down on him, pinning him to the floor. Mitch sent him to sleep with a vicious kick in the head. He realized he'd been moving in a blur, but now his mind was crystal clear, sharper than it ever had been. Where was Babe? Simple. Since she couldn't have ridden away from the place, she must have walked. Mitch was positive he knew where she had walked to. What to do with the pig? Also simple. The materials for taking care of him were readily at hand. Mitch turned on the water in the tub. He went out into the hall and returned with two sacks full of quick-drying plaster. He left the pig very well taken care of, sitting in plaster up to his chin. Then, guessing it would be faster, he ran down the stairs and out to the Cadillac. Wheel spinning, he whipped it down the horseshoe driveway and out onto the highway. He slowed down after a mile or two, peering off to his right at the weed-grown fields that lay opposite the ocean. Suddenly, he jerked the car onto the shoulder and braked it to a stop. He got out, his eyes narrowed with grim satisfaction. He was approximately parallel now with the place where he had assumed the identity of Martin Lonsdale, the place where Martin Lonsdale had supposedly committed suicide. Out there in this fallow field was an abandoned produce shed. From the highway, it appeared to be utterly dark, deserted, but as Mitch leaped the ditch and approached it, he caught a faint flicker of light. He came up on the building silently. He peered through a crack in the sagging door. There was a small stack of groceries in one corner of the room and also a large desert-type water bag. Blankets were spread out in another corner, and well back from the door, a can of beans was warming over an external stove. A man stood over it, looking impatiently down at the food. Mitch knew who he was, even without the sunglasses and cap. He also knew who he was not. But this man was bald and well under 6 feet tall. Mitch kicked open the door and went in. The guy let out a startled "Gah!" as he flung himself forward, swinging. He shouldn't have done it, of course. Mitch was sore enough at him as it was. A full uppercut and the guy soared toward the roof. He came down horizontal, landing amidst the groceries. Mitch snatched him to his feet and slapped him back to consciousness. All right, let's have the story. All of it. Straight. You get me? Don't ask me what story, or I'll... I'll tell you, the man babbled frantically. We tied into Lonsdale at a motor court. We figured he was carrying heavy, so Babe pulled the tears for a ride. We was just gonna hold him up, you know? Honest to God, that's all. But he put up a fight, and you had to bump him. No, the man protested. He dropped dead on us. I swear he did. I just pulled a knife on him. Hadn't touched him at all. When he keeled over, went out like a light. I guess maybe he must have had a bad ticker or something. But anyways, Mitch nodded judiciously. The pig had indicated that Lonsdale was in bad health. Okay, keep singing. Well, he didn't have hardly any dough in cash like we thought he would. Just a mass of checks. But we pumped him for a lot of info. We figured if we could find the right kind of chump, a guy that could pass for Lonsdale. So you did a little riding up and down the highway until you found him and you just damn near got him killed. He gave the guy an irritated shake. The man whimpered apologetically. We didn't mean to, mister.
We really figured we was doing you a favor, giving you a chance to make a piece of change.
I'll bet. So skip it. Where's Babe?
At the hotel.
Nuts, Mitch slapped him. You were going to hold up here until the heat was off. Now where the hell is she? The man began to babble again. Babe hadn't known how soon she could scram. There'd be no set time for joining him here. She had to be at the hotel. If she wasn't, he didn't know where she was.
Maybe run out on me, he added bitterly. Never could trust her around the corner. I don't see how she could get away, but...
Mitch jerked a fist swiftly upward. When the guy came to, he was naked and the room had been stripped of its food, water, and other supplies. His clothes and everything else were bundled into one of the blankets, which Mitch was just lugging out the door.
Wait, the man looked at him fearfully. What are you going to do?
The question, said Mitch, is what are you going to do? He left. A mile or so back up the road, he threw the stuff into the ditch. He arrived at the hotel, parked, and indulged in some very deep thinking. Babe had to be inside the joint. This money-hungry outfit was hiding her for a price. But exactly where, in which of its numerous rooms, the countless nooks and crannies, cellars and sub-cellars that a place like this had, there was no way of telling, or finding out. The employees would know nothing. They'd simply hide themselves if they saw him coming. Naturally, he couldn't search the place from top to bottom. It'd take too long. Delivery men, maybe other guests, would be showing up. And there was the pig to contend with. Someone must have driven him out here, and he wouldn't have planned to stay later than morning. So someone would be calling for him, and... never mind. He had to find Babe. He had to do it fast. Since he had no way of learning her hiding place, there was only one thing to do, force her out of it. Leaving the hotel, Mitch walked around to the rear and located a rubbish pile. With no great difficulty, he found a 5-gallon lard can and a quantity of rags. He returned to the parking lot. He shoved the can under the car's gas tank and opened the petcock. While it was filling, he knotted the rags into a rope. Then, having shut off the flow of gasoline, he went to the telephone booth and called the hotel switchboard. The clerk manager answered. He advised Mitch to beat it before he called the cops.
I know you're not Lonsdale. You understand I know you're a crook. And if you're not gone from these premises in 5 minutes...
Look who's talking, Mitch jeered. Go ahead and call the cops. I'd like to see you do it, you liver-lipped, yellow-bellied... The manager hung up. Mitch called him back. Now get this, he said harshly. You said I was a crook. All right, I am one and I'm dangerous. I'm a crib man, an explosives expert. I got plenty of stuff to work with. So send that dame out here and do it fast or I'll blow your damn shack apart.
Really? My, my. The man laughed sneeringly but somewhat shakily. Just think of that.
I'm telling you, Mitch said, this is the last time I'm telling you. Get that dame out of the woodwork or there won't be any woodwork left.
You wouldn't dare. If you think you can bluff
in exactly 5 minutes, Mitch cut in, the first charge will be set off outside. If that dame doesn't come out, your building goes up. He replaced the receiver, went back to the car, picked up the rags and the gasoline, moved down the walk to the red and white mailbox. It stood in the deep shadows of the porte cochere, and he was not observed. Also, the hotel employees apparently were keeping far back from the entrance. Mitch soaked the rag rope in the gasoline and tucked the length of it down inside the mailbox. Then he lifted the can and trickled its entire contents through the letter slot. It practically filled the box to the brim. The fluid oozed through the seams and dripped down on the ground. Mitch carefully scrubbed his hands with a handkerchief, then ignited a book of matches and dropped them on the end of the rope. Then he ran. His flight was unnecessary, as it turned out, virtually unnecessary, for the bomb was an almost embarrassing failure. There was a weak rumble, a kind of growl. A hungry man's stomach, Mitch thought bitterly, would have made a louder one. A few blasts of smoke and the box jiggled a bit on its moorings. That was the size of it. That was the explosion. It wouldn't have startled a nervous baby. As for scaring the rats inside the joint, hell, they were probably laughing themselves sick. Sure, the box burned. It practically melted. That would give them some trouble, but that didn't help Mitch any.
From far down the lawn, he looked dejectedly at the dying flames, wondering what to do now. He gasped, his eyes widening suddenly as two women burst through the entrance of El Ciudad. One, the one in the front, was Babe, bare-legged, barefooted, dressed only in bra and panties. She screamed as she ran, slapping and clawing wildly at her posterior. It was easy to see why, for the woman chasing her was Beth, and Beth was clutching a blazing blowtorch. She was holding it in front of her, a long blue flame aimed straight at the brassy blonde's flanks. Babe increased her speed, but Beth stayed right with her. They came racing down the lawn towards it. Beth tripped and stumbled, torch flying from her hands. At practically the same instant, Babe collided head-on with the steel flagpole. The impact knocked her senseless, leaving her to listen to the birdies. Mitch sat down by Beth and drew her onto his lap. Beth threw her arms around him, hugging him frantically. "You're all right, honey? I was so worried about you. You didn't really think I meant the way I acted, did you?"
"I wouldn't have blamed you if you had," Mitch said.
"Well, I didn't. Of course, I was awfully mad at you, but you are my husband. I feel like murdering you myself lots of times, but I'm certainly not going to let anybody else do it."
"That's my girl." Mitch kissed her fondly, "but
I thought it was the best thing to do, honey. Just play dumb, then go get some help."
"Well, just a minute," Mitch interrupted. "Where's your car?"
"Over by the ocean," Beth pointed, continued. "Like I was saying, I found her listening out in the hall. I mean, she ducked away real fast, but I knew she'd been listening, so I figured you'd probably be all right for a little while, and I'd better see about her."
"Right," Mitch nodded. "You did exactly right, honey."
"Well, she had a room just a few doors away, Mitch. I guess they had to move her nearby because they didn't have much time. Anyway, she went in, and I went right in with her. She asked Babe the score. Babe told her to go jump. Beth had gone to work on her, ripping off her clothes in the process. Babe had spilled after a time, and Beth had learned, consequently, that there'd be no help for Mitch unless she provided it. So I locked her in and went back to your room, but you were gone. I guessed you must be all right from the looks of things. That guy in the bathtub, I mean." She burst into giggles. "He looked so funny. How in the world do you ever think of these stunts?"
"It just comes natural, I guess," Mitch murmured modestly. "You're gone, precious."
"Well, I went back to her room, and the clerk called and said you were threatening to blow up the place. She wouldn't go for it. She said she was going to stay right there no matter what. And anyway, you were just bluffing." "Well, I was pretty sure you was, too. But I knew you wanted to get her outside, so I went out in the hall and dug up that big cigar lighter." Mitch chuckled and kissed her again. "You did fine, Babe. I'm really proud of you. You gave her a good frisk, I suppose. Searched the bags?" Beth nodded, biting her lips. "Mitch, she don't have the money. Don't look so down about it."
"I didn't figure she'd keep it with her. She'd dish it outside somewhere."
"Mitch, you don't understand. I talked to her and..."
"I know. She's a stubborn girl." He got to his feet. "I'll fix that. But Mitch, she told me where she put the money when I was chasing her with the torch."
"Told you? Why, you didn't say so. Where is it, for Pete's sake?"
"It isn't, but it was." She pointed toward the hotel.
"It was up there."
"Huh?
What are you talking about?"
She mailed it to herself."
Sick with self-disgust, Mitch climbed behind the wheel of Beth's car and turned it onto the highway. Beth studied his dark face. She patted him comfortingly on the knee. "Don't take it so hard, honey. It wasn't your fault."
"Well, whose was it then? How can a guy be so stupid and live so long? $50,000 and I do myself out of it. To do it to myself, that's what kills me."
"But you can't expect to be perfect, Mitch. No one can be smart all the time."
"Nuts," Mitch grunted bitterly. "When was I ever smart?"
Bet declared stoutly that he'd been smart lots of times. "Lots. And lots of times. You know you have, honey. Just look at all the capers you pulled. Just think of all the people who are trying to find you. I guess they wouldn't be, would they, if you hadn't outsmarted them?"
"Well,"
Mitch's shoulders straightened a little. Bet increased her praise. Why, I bet you're the best hustler that ever was. I bet you could steal the socks off a guy with sore feet without taking off his shoes. You really mean that, honey? I most certainly do, Bet nodded vigorously. They just don't make him any sneakier than my Mitch. Why, I'll bet you the biggest heel in the world. Mitch sighed out a note of content. Bet snuggled close. They rode on through the night, moving inappropriately enough toward the City of Angels. That was it. The end. Jim Thompson. Population 12B, that's another one of his great novels. The Frightening Fremis, this is a short story published February 1957. He actually published 26 novels, and this is the first of several stories that introduced the character Mitch Allison. This story is taken from Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery magazine. I don't really know what to say in 3 minutes. I could ramble on about what I'll probably read next time, but I don't really know what I'll read next time. I'd like to make next time an hour earlier, but that's a discussion I'm not going to have with anyone right now. I suppose at some point I will be reading some of the other people I listed: Stephen Milhauser, Barbara Kingsolver, Georges Bataille, and try to stay on the lookout for new authors. I tried to get people to vote, but if anybody has any short story writers or other fiction writers that they'd like to hear, get in touch with me through various social medias. And I'm not going to read any memoirs. So yeah, no nonfiction, no memoirs. Even though all writing is fiction, some people think that, like, if you call it, like, biography or history or nonfiction or memoir, that it's actually true. But there's no more truth than what you can get out of a good fiction. And anybody who's telling you the truth is probably a liar, since everybody knows the truth cannot be told. Okay, you've been listening to Good Night Norman. Me, your host, Norman Douglas.